Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Jonathan. That really was fitting for what we're going to talk about here for the next few minutes. You know, we go through these periods of life where days are kind of exciting and we have a lot to look forward to, and then there's these periods where life just kind of hits you all of a sudden, and didn't see that one coming. And for me personally, the last few weeks, I had three major deaths. I lost one of the cousins that I was closest with to cancer. Just in the last week or so, I announced it here last week, but my closest friend from high school, their only child committed suicide. It was very unexpected. There wasn't just no telltale signs at all, you know, that they could see, that we could see. And last night, I got to speak with him again. I've been trying to talk to him every other day, and he told me what had happened that evening, and that he was the one that found her, and that she used his gun to do it. And so he's struggling with that. And you know, as I look back on my life, I can see where a few years ago I decided to invite God in, and I chose to start acknowledging him in my life. And it was shortly after that I realized acknowledging is not enough, that I need to interact with him, because he wants to interact with me. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And I want you don't necessarily have to take out pen and paper, but I want to take just a real tiny little quiz. And you're going to have responses based upon a scale of 1 to 10. 10 being not necessarily perfect, because we're not, but 10 meaning that you put all the effort that the knowledge you have so far gives you ability. And 0 or 1 means you're not putting forth any effort whatsoever. There's only 5 questions. First one, how is your prayer life? Is it a 2, a 5, an 8? Or are you giving it your all? Second one, do I read and study his word? Maybe I should add on a daily basis. Number 3, do I give to him and others in a way that pleases him? Again, how much effort are you putting into that? Not willingness, but effort. Number 4, have I truly put all aspects of my life in his hands? And then number 5 is, how well do I interact with him? So not just simply do the things that he asks of me, but where's my desire level at? Does it match his desire level? Now I want to take that same quiz, but I want to go back a year. Where were you at a year ago? Where was your prayer life? Where was your study life? Where was your servitude? Were you putting all aspects of your life in his hands? And how well were you interacting with him? Now the question is, the numbers you wrote down in your mind or on paper, in your phone notes, did they increase or decrease over this past year? Hopefully they're increasing. You know, with the circumstances for me in the last few weeks, why I had to consider, you know, what's going on in my life. Am I doing everything that I can? But these events that took place in around me, I also had to consider how others that I care for deeply are being affected by these circumstances. And for the most part, these are people that I guess you and I would say are out in the world. It's not that they don't have knowledge of God, but maybe they're not choosing a whole lot to do something with that knowledge. And that leaves them in a situation where one of two things is going on. They're either coping or they're hoping. I appreciated Linda's testimony because I can tell you I read that book several years ago, and that made a huge influence on me and how I looked at things. And it wasn't from tithing, it was how I interact with God, that He just craves interaction from each one of us. And the fact that even though I thought I was interacting at the time, and I was to some extent, maybe it was only a one, maybe a two and a half, I don't know. But it certainly wasn't a 7, 8, or 9, let alone a 10. Because God created us with a free will spirit, that means He's allowed us to hope or to cope. We can choose to ignore Him, and we can simply cope with whatever this world or this physical life throws at us. Or we can choose to interact with Him and have hope for not just today, but for all time. We got to consider who's in charge of this world right now. Because we have the opportunity to deal with whatever this world throws at us. I mean, whatever Satan wants to throw at us. So do we, as we live our daily lives, do we interact with God in a way that we treat Him as a God, the one and only God? Do we simply do the things that we know He requires or asks of us? Or do we go to Him as a loving Father and ask Him for help, ask Him for guidance, ask Him for wisdom, ask Him for comfort and peace and strength through all this? Do we ask Him for miracles? The setting is there's a famine that's been going on for quite some time. And this mom of a young child is concerned about food. She's a widow. And the food supplies are dwindling down fast. And somehow she's had interaction with God. We know that she knows who God is. And we're going to pick up the story in 1 Kings 17. In verse 9, God's talking to Elijah. He says, "Go now to Zarephath, which belongs in Sidon, and live there. For I have commanded a widow there to feed you." Verse 10, "So he set out and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the town, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, 'Bring me a little water in a vessel so that I may drink.' And as she was going to get it, he called to her and says, 'Hey, wait a second. While you're doing that, bring me back a little bit of bread in your hand.' And she replied in verse 12, and she says, 'As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of meal in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I'm now gathering a couple of sticks so that I may go home and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it, our last meal, and die.'" How often do we cling to physical things rather than going to God and asking for a miracle or a blessing? It sounds like she's kind of given up hope at this point, that God's not going to answer her prayers, And that she just has to live with the consequences of whatever this physical life throws at her. Verse 13, Elijah says to her, "Do not be afraid. Go and do as I have said. But first, make me a little cake and bring it to me. And afterwards, make something for yourself and your son." And this is just a side note, since Linda brought up this message from, or the book by Robert Morris, this is one of his big points, is it's not about tithing, it's about giving God the first, giving him the first fruits. And he uses this as one of the examples. God right here is interacting with us, and he says, first, do what I say, and then you will be blessed. In verse 14, "For thus says the Lord of God of Israel, the jar of meal will not be emptied, and the jug of oil will not fail until the day that the Lord sends rain on the earth." So she went and did as Elijah said, so that as well as he and her household ate for many days. So not only was there enough to eat for the next meal, but there was enough to eat for all of them. And the way I read that, as often as they wanted. If they wanted a midnight snack, there was food there for them. I want us to start thinking about God in that manner, that he doesn't simply want to give us the next meal. He wants to give us the next meal in abundance. However, she could have chose to just simply cling on to that little bit of wheat and oil that she had and ate that last meal, and it was sustained her for how long? Hours? But when God got involved and we went to him first, he blesses us miraculously and perpetually. In verse 16, "The jar of meal was not emptied, neither did the jug of oil fail, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke to Elijah. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill. His illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him." She turns to Elijah, and I don't know how long this was. Now, God told Elijah to go live there, so that sounds like it could have been a long time. But, this might have been weeks, might have been months, maybe it was a couple of years. But when we get down just a little bit further, it's still, young man is still considered a boy or a child. So we know it hasn't been too many years at the most. But she's allowed coping or lack of hope to creep back into her life. And she's questioning, not really Elijah, she's questioning God. She wants to know, why is my son allowed to die? In verse 19, "But Elijah says to her, give me your son. He took him from her bosom, carried him up into the upper chamber where he was lodging, and laid him on his own bed. And he cried out to the Lord, O Lord my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I'm staying by killing her son?" Now we can read that statement to God in a couple of different ways. Was Elijah condemning God for this act? Or was he just simply asking God, is this your will? Did you really want this to happen? Is this part of your plan that I have to, without the rest of your knowledge, deal with for the moment? Because again, we have to consider the fact that it's not God who kills. He requires death. But if we go back to the story of Job, who killed Job's children? Satan. What did God tell Job, or tell Satan, when he unleashed Satan towards Job? "You can do anything you want, but you cannot kill him." I think Elijah knows who's in charge, that God is in charge, and so he asks for a miracle. Then he stretched himself on the child 3 times and cried out to the Lord, "O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again." The Lord listened to the voice of Elijah. The life of the child came to him again, and he was revived. I think back when Elizabeth DeFranco passed away, Alan called me very early that morning, you know, shortly after it happened, and I arrived at the house, and then shortly after that, Garrett Gonzalo arrived at the house. And events are still somewhat of a blur, but right about the time Liz was being removed from the house, Garrett asked if all of us could join up in prayer. And we prayed to God that she would be revived. I didn't know if it would do any good. And I can tell you back then, I had big speculations that it would do any good. But you know, I got to thank Garrett for asking us to do that, because it's brought me much comfort since then, knowing that I asked God for a miracle. And I was okay with his will. But I certainly don't have to go back and think, oh man, what would have happened now with this new knowledge? What would have happened if we hadn't have asked? You know, he just simply wants to treat us as a loving father. He wants to grant us our desires. And where did those desires come from? We were created like him. The desires we have in our hearts, the ones that are good, came from him. They're the same desires as his own. In verse 23, Elijah took the child, brought him down from the upper chamber into the house, and gave him to his mother. Then Elijah said, "See, your son is alive." So the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord is in your mouth." She knew God all along. She knew that Elijah was probably a man of God. Maybe she was testing, maybe she was questioning that. Let's look at Christ's desire for our relationship between us and him and the Father. If we go to John in chapter 17, in verse 20, Christ says, "I ask not on my behalf of these, but also on behalf of those who will believe in me through their word, that they may all be one, as you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given them, so that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, that they may become completely one, so that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me." Think about that last statement. "So that the world will know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me." Our lives are not supposed to look anything like the people's lives that are in the world. There's when it talks about us being a lampstand, people out in the world should be looking at our lives and just going, "How in the world does that happen to you? That doesn't happen to anybody else." So why do we keep trying to embrace what the world has to offer and keep it in our lives? You know, if we're to be a living sacrifice, like Jonathan just sang in the song, you know, that means we're going to bear witness to his glory, his power, and his love. Or are we just simply like a good portion of the world, where we just simply acknowledge that there's a God, but we never allow him to be God and do miracles? In Matthew 7, verse 9, it says, "Is there any among you who, if your child asks for bread, will give a stone? Or if the child asks for a fish, will you give them a snake? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good things to those who ask him?" You know, again, it uses the example of a father and a child. You know, when one of these young children come up and ask for something, we don't want to turn them down. We may have to. It may be good for them to, for us to say no, but we don't want to. And how often do we say, well, no, you can't do that, or you can't have this, but instead, what if we do this? You still want to appease them, reward them, make them happy, make them comfortable. You know, it's easy for us to ask and hope for a miracle in dire circumstances, but what about everyday life? And that's what Matthew 7 is talking about. Everyday life, do we go to him and ask him for his blessing, for his will to be done, for his guidance in the whole situation? And how would he have us live this life that we've turned over to him? Recently I was listening to a message, and there's a line that jumped right out at me. He said, "If you don't have a God story in the last 7 days, that's just totally unacceptable." Meaning, you're not interacting. You know, when we're confronted with problems, how long do we hold out before we truly turn it over to God in every respect? We give him not just the concerns of logistics, but we give him the worries. We give him the heartache. We give him the pain. Sadly, too often, just like the rest of the world, we feel like, and I'm very good at this, you know, if I just do this, I can make it better by doing this. Maybe. But if I do that, the sustainability of it maybe only be for one meal. You know, what really is the benefit of going to God and asking for his total intervention in our lives? You know, we just read about the widow and that widow. Her life was sustained indefinitely because of that interaction. What about Abraham? When God asked him to give up his son, when God asked Abraham to just pack up and head out, not somewhere, but just away. What about Noah? When God approached Noah and said, "I want you to do something for me." Abraham became a nation, how big? Noah and his family saved the world as we know it. Luke 12, verse 29. "And do not keep striving for what you are to eat and what you are to drink, and do not keep worrying. For it is the nation of the world that strive after all these things, and your Father knows that you need them." This is Luke 12 and verse 31 now. "Instead, strive for his kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well. Do not be afraid, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." So what are some of the areas in our lives that we are still just not turning over to him? We're not going to him and asking for his interaction with us on it. Especially those areas where we tend to embrace the social norm. I'm going to throw a few out you, but here I would like for your interaction. If you think of an area, you know, that you'd like to share. A big one for me, we're having three boys and now quickly approaching the age of potential marriage. Marriage is a big thing on my plate in the last few years. And so as I started interacting with God, it opened my mind to the fact that, you know, why don't we teach our children at a very young age to go to God once they're capable of praying an educated prayer, I guess, around 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and all through those years, go to God and say, Father, will you close my eyes to those that come in front of me in terms of a potential spouse until you open my eyes and that potential spouse that you have chosen is standing right in front of me. That I don't go dating 100 looking for the one, but I go seeking the one that you have already chosen for me. What would marriages look like if we started teaching our children to do that? Because, again, all of us can get married, and we can go to God after the fact and say, Father, I need some help in my marriage, and he will do that because he loves being asked for help. But what if we go to him in advance and say, Father, perform the miracle. You put in my heart a desire to be married. You put that there. Which means if I want to walk towards that desire, you want to bless that desire. That there is a perfect mate out there for me that you've already chosen that you will bless me with if only I will allow you to bless me with that miracle. What about career? Again, that young teenager, if we taught them to start praying to God, Father, what would you have me do with my life? Where would you have me go about it? He's already told us we don't have to worry about food, clothing, and shelter. He's going to provide that if we let him. So what do we need the career for? I would bet that we need the career as an opportunity to serve him. That if we go to him first, he will say, yes, I would have you serve over in this area. And while you're serving in this area, I'm going to bless you with time and opportunity to spend time with your children to raise them in my word. Instead of someone that goes out, finds a career where they have to work 60, 70, 80 hours a week to maintain the career and virtually never get to spend any valuable or quality time with their children. Education is the same thing. Do we need education? Yes. But how do we go and why do we go about that education? If it's purely to go find a career to bless us with food, fancy cars, and a big house, I don't know if we're lining up with God's will. Again, why can't we go to him and say, Father, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, what would you have me do? How would you have me go about gaining more knowledge so that I can serve you better? And that might be at a 4-year school. That might be at an 8-year school, going towards a doctor's degree, a degree in medicine, or just a doctorate or a master's. But what happens when we ask God to bless us with those things, and he does, it's just pure and simply a blessing rather than a set of circumstances that now we have to wander through. We can always choose to bless ourselves, but you know what? I know I'm not very good at being a God. So my miracles are pretty minuscule. But if I go to him and ask him for a miracle, he will do just that. He will bless me with a miracle. May not be the one that I could imagine in my head, but he will bless me with a miracle. Outside of those areas, what about personal ministry? Do we ever go to God and just say, Father, at this point in my life, I don't feel like I've got time to do a whole lot of personal ministry, but I read in your word that that's what you would like me, you would have me do. So will you show me where, how, to whom, when? Will you just start opening my eyes to how I can do that? Don't do that. He's going to say no. Now, how fearful are we to ask that prayer, knowing that he will bless us? And like, I don't know if I've got time for this. He's going to ask me to go to Ecuador. He's going to send me up to Alaska. I don't want to do that. May not be the blessing as you can imagine it, but it will be a blessing and it will be a miracle. Feast plans. Again, I'm kind of talking about some areas in my life that he's opened up my eyes to in the last few years. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, he says, set apart a tithe of all the yield of your seed that is brought in yearly from the field. In the presence of the Lord your God, in the place that he will choose as a dwelling for his name, you shall eat the tithe of your grain, your wine, your oil, as well as the firstlings of your herd and your flock, so that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. In the place that he will choose. So for 47 years of my life, I said, Father, I'm going to the feast. And I choose to go here this year. The first time I went to him with this prayer and said, Father, I just learned or read that you're the one that's supposed to do the choosing, not me. When it comes to Days of Unleavened Bread, Pentecost, and the Tabernacles, those three feasts, when they're mentioned in Scripture, it says he in the place that he chooses, not that we choose. I went to him here a couple of years ago for the spring feast, and it turned out I was supposed to help coordinate one locally. And then last year, as many of you know, I asked him again for the fall feast, and we end up in Kenya, Africa. And again, that was, for our family, and especially me as the head of the family, that's just way beyond what my thought process could handle from the standpoint monetarily. We can't think about going there. The logistics, that's just not going to work. And you know what? He took care of it all. It was this amazing blessing because it was a miracle. We got to see him in action. Not in just one event, but all throughout. Every day that we were gone or on the trip, watching the prices of the tickets come down to a point where we could afford them, and then seeing they haven't been there in the past and they haven't been there since, you know, and the logistics of getting around when we couldn't even make the logistics for ourselves. We had to rely upon some other people, and they didn't at times do a very good job, but yet God still protected us and got us to the places we needed to be in a comfortable manner, more comfortable than what they could have been in a lot of circumstances. But it was just amazing to watch him say, no, I got the whole thing. I didn't just promise one little aspect. I did the whole thing for you. So if he gives you back an answer and he wants you to do something like going to the feast in a particular location, don't start throwing at him, yeah, but he's got that. He's already taken care of it. along with the feast plans, what is it, 2 years ago, the Palmers and us were going up to South Dakota for the feast. Our family vehicles had well over 200,000 miles on them. And we felt comfortable with them, but we know, boy, if there's an opportunity for something to go wrong, this trip is going to be it. So Todd and I were talking about one day, and we just said, you know what, let's go out and pray over our vehicles right now. So we did. We asked God to protect not just the trip, the feast overall, but specifically our vehicles, that they would give us. The vehicle we took, I still got out here in the parking lot. It's got 304,000 miles on it. And it's still going strong. And I wouldn't hesitate right now to jump in and go to South Dakota, let alone 3 years ago. What about day-to-day tasks? You know, as I think most of you know, I'm a goldsmith. And one of the most intricate things I need to do on pretty much a daily basis is set in prongs or some type of setting an expensive stone. And when I first got hired by my boss, I'd been working for him for a good handful of months, but we were still getting to know each other a little bit. When he interviewed me, part of the interview process is he gave me some tasks to do. He had me size a ring up and down. He had me set a couple of stones. He had me solder some chains. And during that process, he's standing over my shoulder. And most people, when we use a set of pliers, if these are the handles, we grab hold of them like this, right? We use them like this, kind of like we would shears. Well, when it comes to setting a stone, that stone's sitting right here in front of me. I have a bench, you know, a little bench vise, so it's about chin level, so I can get right into it with my eyeballs if need be. But at that point, to use pliers, it's kind of an awkward. I got my elbow way up in the air. So I decided early on, that's not the way to hold pliers in this circumstance. I started holding them like this. My hands were not in the way anymore. They were back behind the pliers. It was very comfortable. I had just as much control and power, you know. He saw that, and apparently he flipped out because he went home that night, and his wife said, so how'd the interview go with that Aaron? He says, terrible. She says, why? He doesn't know how to hold pliers. I set the stone just fine. But it just threw him way off guard that I was holding pliers in this really strange way. And she said, did he set the stone fine? Yeah, then you hire him. Because she was tired of him being at the store every night. And so now this is months later, and I'm setting a stone. And he came to me that morning after I first got there, and he says, Aaron, I got this stone. It's a little bit of a rush. It needs to be done before noon. Okay. I go to set the stone, the pliers slip off the prong and snap against the edge of the stone. It's called the girdle of the stone, and chips it. It's a $1,500 stone. That's our cost on the stone. And I have never had to go to him and say, oh man, something bad happened. I didn't know how he'd react, and in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I just lost my job. So I went to him, told him what happened. He says, don't worry about it. He says, quite honestly, he says, I can't tell you how many stones I've chipped over time. He says, it's not like you do it every day. This is the first one. He says, I'm sure you learned something. He says, the strange thing is, I have an identical twin to that stone. When I bought that stone, it was in a little parcel. There was two identical stones. He says, I don't even need to tell the customer about this, because they literally are identical. They're identical in weight, in size, shape, color, clarity. Everything, they're identical. So don't worry about it. Okay, good. He didn't fire me. He says, go to lunch. You need a break. You need to calm your nerves down. I said, yep. Went to lunch, come back. He says, all right, here's the other stone. Get this set for me. I chipped the second stone. That was a bad day for me and Alan. Again, he said, don't worry about it. We'll figure out something. God blessed me with an amazing family to work for long before I asked him into my life. But since then, I've learned that now, again, on a daily basis, I can have in my hands a $30,000 stone that I need to set in just a few minutes. You know what I do? Father, I need to set this stone. I need your help. I can't do this. So will you please take control right now? It's been quite a while since I've chipped a stone. Do I think I'll never chip a stone again? Nope. Don't feel that way at all. But you know what? I ask him for his intervention now on every single one of those. So is there any areas in your life where you'd like to share that God could, you could interact better with God, or that you learned in the last couple of years to interact with God in? If not, that's fine. So let's, now we got to think about something. When is it selfish for me to ask for something? Is it selfish for me to ask him to help me set a stone? Is it selfish if I ask him to save my life? Somebody else's life? Let's turn to Luke 22. Verse 42. Christ cries out, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Yet not my will be, but yours be done. Is it surprising that Christ would ask that prayer? He knew what was happening. He knew why it was happening. He knew what needed to be happening. But yet he had been sent here as a human to experience everything that we experience, and to also be an example. And that prayer is in Scripture, not just this one time, but multiple times. And as the story goes, he prayed it that night three different times. Read verse 43 with me. Then an angel from heaven appeared to him and gave him strength. So did God answer his prayer? Did God hear his prayer? May not have been the exact answer he was hoping for, but God says, you know what? I know what you need. You need a little bit of extra strength. I'm sending an angel right now. Are there areas in your life right now that you're struggling with, that you're anguished over, that you're unsure where to go? Have you truly went to God and say, I just need to put this in your hands and wait for your response to me? What about a group setting? Miles, if you want to get that ready. I found a very interesting clip that I want to play here real quick in video. And as I listened to it the first time, I had already pulled up the scripture in John 17:23. It says, I in them and you in me, that they may become completely one, so that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. And I realized, you know, that's not just simply referring to me as an individual, that's referring to us as the body as well. And so this clip is actually a speech that Benjamin Franklin gave in front of the Constitutional Convention on June 28, 1787. Miles, if you want to go do that, you know where the volume's at for this? Yeah, go ahead. And
In this situation of this assembly, groping, as it were, in the dark to find political truth, and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding? In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. To that kind providence, we owe this happy opportunity of consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future national felicity. And have we now forgotten that powerful friend? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. The sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice. Is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings that, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this. And I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our little partial local interests. Our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down the future ages. And what is worse, mankind may hereafter, from this unfortunate instance, despair of establishing governments by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, and conquest. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings in our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of the city be requested to officiate in that service.
Go ahead and turn that off. Benjamin Franklin understood that not only God would answer those prayers, but the entire world would see the effects of those answers. And they have. So the last question I have is that same test that or quiz that we started off with, but this time instead of for us as individuals, as the body. Do we pray to him as a body the way we should or could? Do we study his word the way we should or could? Do we give to him and others in service as we should and could? Have we as a body truly turned every aspect of this life into his hands? And as we do that, do we interact with him rather than simply reacting to him? That's all I've got. Questions or comments?